Penguin Random House Audio presents Great Circle by Maggie Shipstead. Read for you by Cassandra Campbell and Alex McKenna.
For my brother. I live my life in widening circles that reach out across the world. I may not complete this last one, but I give myself to it. I circle around God, around the primordial tower. I've been circling for thousands of years, and I still don't know. Am I a falcon, a storm, or a great song? Rainer Maria Rilke, The Book of Hours. If you were to put a blade through any sphere and divide it into two perfect halves, the circumference of the cut side of each half would be a great circle, that is, the largest circle that can be drawn on a sphere. The equator is a great circle. So is every line of longitude. On the surface of a sphere such as the Earth, the shortest distance between any two points will follow an arc that is a segment of a great circle. Points directly opposite each other, like the North and South Poles, are intersected by an infinite number of great circles. Little America 3, Ross Ice Shelf, Antarctica, March 4th, 1950. Final entry from The Sea, the Sky, the Birds Between, The Lost Logbook of Marion Graves. Published by D. Wenceslaus and Sons, New York, 1959. I was born to be a wanderer. I was shaped to the earth like a seabird to a wave. Some birds fly until they die. I have made a promise to myself. My last descent won't be the tumbling, helpless kind, but a sharp gennet plunge. A dive with intent, aimed at something deep in the sea. I'm about to depart. I will try to pull the circle up from below, bringing the end to meet the beginning. I wish the line were a smooth meridian, a perfect taut hoop, but our course was distorted by necessity. The indifferent distribution of islands and airfields, the plane's need for fuel. I don't regret anything, but I will if I let myself. I can think only about the plane, the wind, and the shore, so far away, where land begins again. The weather is improving. We've fixed the leak as best we can. I will go soon. I hate the never-ending day. The sun circles me like a vulture. I want a respite of stars. Circles are wondrous because they are endless. Anything endless is wondrous. But endlessness is torture, too. I knew the horizon could never be caught, but still chased it. What I have done is foolish. I had no choice but to do it. It isn't how I thought it would be, now that the circle is almost closed, the beginning and end held apart by one last fearsome piece of water. I thought I would believe I'd seen the world, but there is too much of the world and too little of life. I thought I would believe I'd completed something, but now I doubt anything can be completed. I thought I would not be afraid. I thought I would become more than I am. But instead, I know I am less than I thought. No one should ever read this. My life is my one possession. And yet.
Los Angeles, December 2014. I only knew about Marion Graves because one of my uncle's girlfriends liked to dump me at the library when I was a kid. And one time I picked up a random book called something like Brave Ladies of the Sky. My parents had gone up in a plane and never come back. And it turned out a decent percentage of the brave ladies had met the same fate. That got my attention. I think I might have been looking for someone to tell me a plane crash wasn't such a bad way to go. Though if anyone actually ever had, I would have thought they were full of shit. Marion's chapter said she'd been raised by her uncle, And when I read that, I got goosebumps because I was being raised, kind of, by my uncle. A nice librarian dug up Marion's book for me, The Sea, the Sky, etc. And I pored over it like an astrologist consulting a star chart, hopeful that Marion's life would somehow explain my own, tell me what to do and how to be. Most of what she wrote went over my head, though I did come away with a vague aspiration to turn my loneliness into adventure. On the first page of my diary, I wrote, "I was born to be a wanderer," in big block letters. Then I didn't write anything else, because how do you follow that up when you're 10 years old and spend all your time either at your uncle's house in Van Nuys or auditioning for television commercials? After I returned the book, I pretty much forgot about Marion. Almost all of the Brave Ladies of the Sky are forgotten, really. There was the occasional spooky TV special about Marion in the 80s, and a handful of die-hard Marion enthusiasts are still out there spinning theories on the internet. But she didn't stick the way Amelia Earhart did. People at least think they know about Amelia Earhart, even though they don't. It's not really possible. The fact that I got ditched at the library so often turned out to be a good thing, because while other kids were at school, I was sitting in a succession of folding chairs in a succession of hallways at every casting call in the greater Los Angeles area for little white girls, or little race unspecified girls, which also means white, chaperoned by a succession of nannies and girlfriends of my Uncle Mitch, two categories that sometimes overlapped. I think the girlfriends sometimes offered to take care of me because they wanted him to see them as maternal, which they thought would make them seem like wife material. But that wasn't actually a great strategy for keeping the flame alive with old Mitch. When I was 2, my parents' Cessna crashed into Lake Superior. Or that's the assumption. No trace was ever found. My dad, Mitch's brother, was flying, and they were on their way to a romantic getaway at some friend's middle-of-nowhere backwoods cabin to, as Mitch put it, reconnect. Even when I was little, he told me that my mother wouldn't quit fucking around. His words. I'm not sure Mitch believed in childhood. "But they wouldn't quit each other either," he'd say. Mitch definitely believed in taglines. He'd started out directing cheesy TV movies with titles like Love Takes a Toll. That was about a toll collector. And Murder for Valentine's Day. Take a wild guess. My parents had left me with a neighbor in Chicago, but their last will and testament left me to Mitch. There wasn't really anyone else. No other aunts or uncles. And my grandparents were a combination of dead, estranged, absent, and untrustworthy. Mitch wasn't a bad guy, but his instincts were of the opportunistic, Hollywoodian variety. So after he'd had me a few months, he called in a favor to get me cast in an applesauce commercial. Then he found my agent, Siobhan, and I got consistent enough work in commercials and guest spots in TV movies. I played the daughter in Murder for Valentine's Day. That I can't remember a time I wasn't acting or trying to. It seemed like normal life. Putting a plastic pony in a plastic stable over and over while cameras rolled and some grown-up stranger told you how to smile. When I was 11, after Mitch had stepping-stoned from movies of the week to music videos and was white-knuckled climbing into the indie film world, I got my proverbial big break. The role of Katie McGee in a time travel cable sitcom for kids called The Big Time Life of Katie McGee. On set, my life was squeaky clean and candy-colored. All puns and tidy plot lines and three-walled rooms under a hot sky of Klieg lights. I hammed it up to a braying laugh track while wearing outfits so extravagantly trendy I looked like a manifestation of the tween zeitgeist. When I wasn't working, I did pretty much whatever I wanted, thanks to Mitch's negligence. In her book, Marion Graves wrote, "As a child, my brother and I were largely left to our own devices. I believed, and no one told me otherwise for some years, that I was free to do as I liked, that I had the right to go any place I could find my way to. I was probably more of an impetuous little brat than Marion, but I felt the same way. The world was my oyster, and freedom was my mignonette. Life gives you lemons, you carve off their skins and garnish your martinis." When I was 13, after the Katie McGee merch had started selling like crazy, and after Mitch had directed Tourniquet and was rolling around in success like a pill-popping pig and shit, he moved us to Beverly Hills on our shared dime. Once I wasn't stuck out in the valley anymore, the kid who played Katie McGee's big brother introduced me to his rich dirtbag high schooler friends, and they drove me around and took me to parties and got in my pants. Mitch probably didn't notice how much I was gone because he was usually out too. Sometimes we'd bump into each other coming home at 2 or 3 in the morning, both messed up, and we'd just exchange nods, like two people passing in a hotel corridor, attendees at the same rowdy conference. But here's a good thing. The on-set tutors for Katie McGee were decent, and they told me I should go to college. And since I liked the sound of that, I weaseled my way into NYU after the show ended, with substantial extra credit for being a B-list TV star. I was already packed and ready to move when Mitch overdosed, and if I hadn't been, I probably would have just stayed in LA and partied myself to death too. Here's something that might have been good or bad. After one semester, I got cast in the first Archangel movie. Sometimes I wonder what would have happened if, instead, I'd finished college and stopped acting and been forgotten about. But it's not like I possibly could have turned down the colossal amount of money that came with playing Katerina. So, everything else is irrelevant. In my blip of higher education, I had time to take Intro to Philosophy and learn about the Panopticon, the hypothetical prison Jeremy Bentham came up with, where there would be one itty-bitty guardhouse at the center of a giant ring of cells. One guard was all you needed because he might be watching at any time, and the idea of being watched matters way more than actually being watched. Then Foucault turned the whole thing into a metaphor about how all you need to discipline and dominate a person, or a population, is to make them think it's possible they're being watched. You could tell the professor wanted us all to think that the Panopticon was scary and awful. But later, after Archangel made me way too famous, I wanted to take Katie McGee's preposterous time machine back to that lecture hall and ask him to consider the opposite. Like, instead of one guard in the middle, you're in the middle. And thousands, maybe millions of guards are watching you. Or might be. All the time, no matter where you go. Not that I would have had the nerve to ask a professor anything. At NYU, everyone was always staring at me because I'd been Katie McGee. But it felt like they were staring at me because they knew I didn't deserve to be there. And maybe I didn't, but you can't measure fairness in a lab. You can't know if you deserve something. Probably you don't. So it was a relief, too, when I quit school for Archangel, to go back to having a million obligations I had no choice about and a daily schedule I didn't decide for myself. At college, I'd flipped through the course catalog, as fat as a dictionary, in complete bafflement. I'd drifted through the cafeteria, looking at all the different foods, at the salad bars and the mountains of bagels and the bins of cereal and the soft serve machine, and I'd felt like I was being asked to solve some monumental life or death riddle. After I wrecked everything and Sir Hugo Woosley, the Sir Hugo, who happens to be my neighbor, started talking to me about some biopic he was producing and pulled Marion's book from his tote bag. A book I hadn't thought about in 15 years. Suddenly, I was in a library again, looking at a slender hardback that might hold all the answers. Answers sounded nice. They sounded like something I wanted. Not that I could ever quite unravel what I wanted. Not that I even really knew what wanting meant. I mostly experienced desire as a tangle of impossible, contradictory impulses. I wanted to vanish like Marion. I wanted to be more famous than ever. I wanted to say something important about courage and freedom. I wanted to be courageous and free, but I didn't know what that meant. I only knew how to pretend to know, which I guess is acting. Today is my last day of filming for Peregrine. I'm sitting in a mock-up of Marion's plane that's hanging from a pulley system and is about to be swung out over a giant tank of water and dropped. I'm wearing a reindeer fur parka that weighs 1,000 pounds and will weigh 1,000,000 once it gets wet. And I'm trying not to let on that I'm afraid. Bart Olofsson, the director, took me aside earlier, asked if I really wanted to do this stunt myself, given, you know, what happened to my parents. "I think I want to confront that," I said. "I think I could use the closure." He'd put his hand on my shoulder, done his best guru face. "You are a strong woman," he'd said. Closure doesn't really exist, though. That's why we're always looking for it. The actor who's playing Eddie Bloom, my navigator, is also wearing a reindeer fur parka and has waterproof blood makeup on his forehead because he's supposed to be knocked out by the impact. In real life, Eddie usually sat at a desk behind Marion's seat, but the screenwriters, two aggressively cheerful brothers with Hitler Youth haircuts and Hitler Youth faces, thought it would be better if Eddie came up front for the death dive. Sure, fine, whatever. The story we're telling isn't what really happened anyway. I know that much. But I wouldn't say I know the truth about Marion Graves. Only she knew. 8 cameras will record my plunge. 6 fixed, 2 operated by divers. The plan is to do it once. Twice at most. It's an expensive shot, and our budget was never enormous, and now has been exhausted, and then some. But when you've come this far, the only way out is through. Best case scenario, it takes all day. Worst case scenario, I drown, wind up in memoriam, wind up like my parents, except in a fake plane and a fake ocean, not even trying to get anywhere. "You're sure you want to do this?" The stunt coordinator is checking my harness, all business as he digs around my crotch, feeling for the straps and clips among bristly reindeer hair. True to type, he's got a leathery face, a leathery wardrobe, and a stop-action way of walking from a few imperfect repair jobs. "Totally," I say. When he's done, the crane lifts us up, swings us out. There's a scrim at the end of the tank that makes a kind of horizon with the water. And I'm her, Marion Graves, flying over the Southern Ocean with my fuel gauge on empty. And I know I can't get anywhere other than where I am, which is nowhere. I wonder how cold the water will be. How long before I'm dead? I think through my options. I think about what I've promised myself. A Gannet plunge. "Action," says a voice in my earpiece. And I push on the fake plane's yoke as though I'm going to fly us down into the center of the earth. The pulleys tip the nose. and we dive.
The Josephina Eterna. Glasgow, Scotland, April 1909. An unfinished ship, a hull without funnels, caged inner slipway by a steel gantry above and a timber cradle below. Beyond her stern, under the four impotent blossoms of her exposed propellers, the River Clyde flowed green in unexpected sunshine. From keel to waterline, she was rust red, and above that, specially painted for the launch, she was white as a bride. White made for better newspaper pictures. After the flash bulbs have popped, after she has been moored lonely in the river for her fitting out, men will stand on planks hung down her sides on thick ropes and paint the plates and rivets of her hull glossy black. Her two funnels will be hoisted up, bolted down, lashed in place. Her decks will be planked in teak, her corridors and salons paneled in mahogany and walnut and oak. There will be sofas and settees and chaises, beds and bathtubs, seascapes in gilded frames, gods and goddesses in bronze and alabaster. The first-class china will be gilt-edged, patterned with gold anchors, the emblem of L&O lines. For second-class, blue anchors, blue edging. Blue, the line's color. Third-class will make do with plain white crockery, and the crew with tin. Boxcars will arrive full of crystal and silver and porcelain, damask and velvet. Cranes will hoist aboard three pianos, dangling in nets like stiff-legged beasts. A grove of potted palms will be wheeled up the gangway. Chandeliers will be hung. Deck chairs hinged like alligator jaws will be stacked. Eventually, the first load of coal will be poured in through apertures low in the hull, down into bunkers below the waterline, far from the finery. The first fire will be lit deep in her furnaces. But on the day of her launch, she was still only a shell, a bare and comfortless wedge of steel. A crowd jostled in her shadow, ship workers in rowdy clumps, Glaswegian families out for the spectacle, urchin boys peddling newspapers and sandwiches. A brilliantly blue sky flew overhead like a pennant. In this city of fog and soot, such a sky could only be a good omen. A brass band played. Mrs. Lloyd Pfeiffer, Matilda, wife of the ship's new American owner, stood on a platform edged with blue and white bunting, a bottle of scotch tucked under her arm. "Shouldn't it be champagne?" she had asked her husband. "Not in Glasgow," he'd said. Matilda was to break the bottle against the ship, christening it with the name she could scarcely bear to think of. She was impatient for the cathartic shattering of glass, for her task to be done. But now she could only wait. There was some kind of delay. Lloyd fidgeted, making occasional comments to the naval architect, who appeared rigid with anxiety. A few unhappy Englishmen in bowler hats milled around the platform, and a pair of Scotsmen from the shipbuilding firm, and several other men she couldn't identify. The ship had already been half-built when L&O Lines, founded in New York by Lloyd's father, Ernst, in 1857, and inherited by Lloyd in 1906, acquired the failing English line that had commissioned it. "Commissioned her," Lloyd was always correcting. But to Matilda, ships would always be its. The sheathing had been underway when money ran out and was resumed once Lloyd's dollars were converted to sterling, then steel. The men in bowler hats, up from London, remarking morosely among themselves about the glorious weather, had conceived of the ship, argued over its blueprints, chosen a sensible name that Lloyd had disregarded. All that, only to have ended up obsolete. cuckolds in carefully brushed hats on a bunting-swagged platform, the brass band's rousing march bubbling around their feet. Tallow had been smeared on the slipway to grease the ship's path, and Matilda could feel its thick animal odor permeating her clothes, coating her skin. Lloyd had wanted a new liner to reinvigorate L&O. When Ernst died, the fleet had been tired and outdated, mostly tramp steamers plying the coastwise trade, plus some passenger cargo ships chugging across the Atlantic, and a few tired wind jammers still running the Pacific grain and guano routes. This ship would not be the largest or fastest or most opulent liner crossing from Europe. No threat to the White Star Line monsters being built in Belfast. But Lloyd had told Matilda it would be a respectable ante at the fat cat's table. "What's the news?" Lloyd barked, startling her. The question was addressed to Addison Graves, Captain Graves, who was standing nearby, looming, really, though his habitual hunch seemed intended as a preemptive apology for his height. He was thin, almost gaunt, but with bones as massive and heavy as cudgels.
"It's a problem with the trigger," he told Lloyd. "Shouldn't be much longer."
Lloyd frowned at the ship. "It's like she's in shackles. She's meant to be at sea, don't you think, Graves?" He turned suddenly ebullient.
"Don't you think she's absolutely magnificent?"
The bow towered over them, sharp as a blade.
"She'll be a fine ship," Graves said mildly.
He was to be the ship's first captain, had come across for the launch with Lloyd and Matilda and the four young Pfeiffer sons, Henry, the eldest, at 7, and Leander, the baby, not even a year old, with Clifford and Robert in between, all being cared for somewhere out of the way by their two nannies. Matilda had hoped to warm up to Graves on the voyage. He was not unkind, never impolite, but his reserve seemed unbreachable. Even her boldest attempts to discover something of his inner workings had yielded nothing. "What drew you to the sea, Captain Graves?" she'd asked one night at dinner. He'd said,
"Go far enough in any direction and you'll find the sea, Mrs. Pfeiffer."
And she'd felt reproached. To her, he'd come to represent the basic impenetrability of male life. Lloyd loved him with a wholeheartedness he didn't seem to lavish on anyone else. Certainly not Matilda.
"I owe him my life," Lloyd had said many times.
"Your life can't be a debt," she'd countered once, "or then it's not really yours, and nothing has been saved." But Lloyd had only laughed, asked if she had considered becoming a philosopher. They had crewed on a bark together as young men, Graves and Lloyd. Graves had been a working sailor, and Lloyd, just graduated from Yale, was half pretending to be. Ernst, Lloyd's father, had said he needed to learn the ropes, literally, if he was to inherit L&O. When hapless Lloyd fell overboard off Chile, Graves was quick and accurate enough to throw him a line and haul him back aboard. Since then, Lloyd had always venerated Graves as a savior. "But you're the one who caught the line," Matilda said. "You're the one who hung on." After Chile, as Lloyd ascended through the firm, so too did Graves. The platform was no longer in the shade. Sweat was making Matilda's corset stick and chafe. Lloyd seemed to think she'd been born knowing how to christen a ship.
"Just break the bottle on the bow, Tildy," he'd said. "It's very simple."
Would she know when the moment came? Would they remember to tell her? All she knew was that she'd apparently be signaled, by whom she wasn't sure, at the moment the ship began to slide, and she was to crack the whiskey against the bow, christening it Josefina Eterna, after her husband's mistress. When, months before, at the breakfast table,
She'd asked Lloyd what the ship would be called. He had told her without lowering his newspaper. Matilda's cup had not rattled when she returned it to its saucer. At least she could be proud of that. She had been young, but not too young, when Lloyd married her, 21 to his 36, old enough to know she was being chosen for her fortune and breeding potential, not love. All she asked was that Lloyd behave with respectful discretion. She had explained this to him before their engagement, and he had listened kindly and agreed there was much to be said for individual privacy within marriage, especially since bachelor life had suited him so well for so long. "We understand each other, then," she had said and offered him her hand. Solemnly, he had shaken her hand and then kissed her, full on the mouth, for quite some time, and she had begun, in spite of herself, to fall in love. Bad luck. But she would not go back on her word. As best she could, she made peace with Lloyd's wanderings, directing her passions toward her children and the maintenance of her wardrobe and person. Lloyd regarded her affectionately, she knew, and was more tender in bed than she gathered some husbands were, though she also knew she was fundamentally not to his taste. He preferred temperamental, unappeasable women, usually older than Matilda, often older than even himself. Older, certainly, than the ship's namesake, this Joe, who was only 19, dark and flighty. But Matilda knew enough to know it was often the lover who went against type who undid people. The ship's name had seemed a poor repayment of her tolerance and generosity. And as soon as she'd found a moment alone, away from rattling china and servants' eyes, she had shed a few tears. Then she'd pulled herself together and soldiered on, as always. On the platform, Lloyd turned to her, wrought up. "It's almost time." She tried to ready herself. The bottle's neck was too short for her to get a good grip, especially not through her silk gloves, and it slipped from her grasp, landed with a thud perilously close to the platform's edge. As she picked it up, someone touched her shoulder. Addison Graves. Gently, he took the bottle. "You'd better remove your gloves," he said. When she had, he wrapped one of her hands around the neck and set the other palm flat against the cork. "Like this," he said, demonstrating a sideways arcing motion. "Don't be afraid to take a good swing, because it's bad luck if the bottle doesn't break."
"Thank you," she murmured. At the platform's edge, she waited for her signal, but nothing happened. The bow stayed where it was, the immense upturned nose of a proud and haughty thing. The men were talking urgently among themselves. The naval architect went rushing off. She waited. The bottle grew heavier. Her fingers ached. Down in the crowd, two men were shoving each other, causing a commotion. As she watched, one struck the other in the face.
"Tildy, for God's sake!"
Lloyd was tugging at her arm. The bow was sliding away so quickly. She had not expected something so large would go so quickly. She leaned out and hurled the bottle after the retreating wall of steel, awkwardly, overhand. It thudded against the hull, but did not break, only bounced off and dropped to the slipway, shattering on the concrete in a splat of glass and amber liquid. The Josefina receded. The river rose up behind the stern in a green bulge, collapsed into foam. North Atlantic, January 1914, 4 years and 9 months later. Josefina Eterna, eastbound in the night. A jeweled brooch on black satin, a solitary crystal on the wall of a dark cave, a stately comet in an empty sky. Below her lights and honeycombed cabins, below the men toiling in red heat and black dust. Below her barnacled keel, a school of cod passed, a dense pack of flexing bodies in the darkness, eyes bulging wide, though there was nothing to see. Below the fish, cold and pressure, empty black miles, a few strange luminescent creatures drifting after flecks of food. Then the sandy bottom, blank except for faint trails left by hardy shrimp, blind worms, creatures who would never know such a thing as light existed. The night Addison Graves came to dinner and found Annabelle seated beside him was the second out of New York. He had descended without enthusiasm from the masculine quiet of the bridge into the dining room's trilling, sparkling cacophony. The air felt hot and moist, smelled of food and perfume. The ocean cold clinging to his wool uniform evaporated. Immediately, he prickled with sweat. At his table, he stooped in a bow, cap under his arm. The passengers' faces radiated a predatory eagerness for his attention. "Good evening," he said as he sat, shaking out his napkin. He rarely gleaned pleasure from conversation, certainly not from the self-congratulatory chit-chat demanded by passengers wealthy or important enough to wrangle seats at the captain's table. At first, he registered nothing beyond the pale green of Annabelle's dress. On his other side sat an older woman in brown. The first of a long series of fussy dishes arrived, borne from a kitchen by tail-coated waiters. Lloyd Pfeiffer had promoted Addison to captain as soon as he'd inherited L&O, when the turned earth was still fresh on his father's grave. Over a steak dinner at Delmonico's, Loy had given him charge of a ship, and Addison had only nodded, not wanting to betray his elation. Captain Graves. The miserable boy he'd been long ago on that farm in Illinois would finally be gone forever. Ground to nothing under the heel of his polished boot, tossed overboard. But Lloyd had raised one small concern. "You'll have to be genial, Graves. You'll have to converse. It's part of what they pay for. Don't look like that. It won't be so bad." He paused, looking anxious. "Do you think you can manage?" "Yes," Addison had said, his ambition outweighing the dread in his heart. "Of course." Waiters swirled around, delivering bowls of consommé. On Addison's right, Mrs. Somebody or Other in the brown dress was relating her son's life histories in great detail and with such slow and deliberate enunciation that she might have been reading out the terms of a treaty. Lamb with mint jelly appeared and was eaten. Then roast chicken. Over the salad, during a brief intermission in his neighbor's recitation, Addison turned finally to the woman in the pale green dress. Annabelle, she'd said her name was. She appeared quite young. He asked if it would be her first time in Britain. "No," she said. "I've been several times."
"Then you enjoy it?"
At first, she did not reply. Then, when she spoke, her tone was matter-of-fact. "Not particularly, but my father and I decided it would be best if I left New York for a while." A curious admission. He studied her more closely. Her head was lowered. She seemed intent on her meal. She was older than he had initially thought, in her late 20s. And extremely fair, though the careless application of her rouge and lipstick gave her a blurred, feverish appearance. She had cream-colored hair like the mane of a palomino horse, and eyelashes and eyebrows so pale as to be almost invisible. Abruptly, she looked up and met his gaze. Her irises were light blue, filigreed with bright, pale, interlocking rings like sun dapples. In them, he recognized a proposition, brazen and unmistakable.
He knew the look from women in the South Pacific lounging bare-breasted in the shade, from whores half-hidden in the gloom of port city alleys, from Karayuki-san ushering him into lantern-lit rooms. He glanced at her father across the table, a florid, wiry man talking boisterously, seemingly oblivious to his daughter.
You despise this, Annabelle said in a low voice, talking to these people. I can tell because I do too.
Addison begged off dessert. Something needed his attention. Do forgive him. He made his way out of the dining room and up two flights of stairs, clanged out through a door, crew only, onto a patch of open deck behind the bridge. He rested his elbows on the railing. No one was around. The sea was lightly chopped. The marbled seam of the Milky Way arced through the clear, moonless sky. He had politely denied despising anything, had turned away from the young woman and asked his other neighbor if she had any more amusing stories about her children. But Annabelle had continued to burn at his periphery. Green dress, pale eyelashes.
That look, so unexpected. A blue flame, unwavering and alien.
There was some relief in the workmanlike atmosphere of the bridge, and later in the midnight pot of coffee brought to his cabin. But still, she burned. In his bath, his bony knees poking out of the water, he had let his hand drift to his groin, thinking of her flushed cheeks, the loose wisps of pale hair at her nape. It was well past midnight when she knocked at his door. She was still in the green dress, an apparition. He didn't know how she had found his cabin, but she stepped briskly inside as though she had been to see him many times before. She was smaller than he'd thought, her head only reaching the middle of his chest, and she was shivering violently. Her skin was bluish and very cold, and for the first few minutes, he could barely stand to touch her for the chill. New York City, September 1914, 9 months later. The babies were crying. Annabelle did not move. She was standing at her bedroom window in Addison's red brick townhouse, black trim, black door with a brass knocker, near the river, and looking across the street at a black cat sleeping in a third floor window. Often it was there. Sometimes, tail flicking, it watched pigeons pecking in the gutters below. When the cat flicked its tail, Annabelle was compelled to wag one finger. When the cat stopped, she stopped. At night, lying sleepless, she would wag her finger until the digit was painfully tight and sore. A scold's gesture. Tick-tock. In overlapping bursts, the crying built to a furious peak. Better not to move from the window than risk the visions that bubbled up, smelling of brimstone when she went near the twins. She should not go in the kitchen where there were knives. She should not venture near down pillows or basins of water. She should not hold the babies in her arms because she might bring them up to this window and drop them from it. Wicked, came her mother's voice. Wicked, wicked, wicked. During one of her stints at boarding school, the morning after an ice storm, she had taken cautious gliding steps off her dormitory's porch and into a blinding, brittle, splintery world. Each maple in the school's central green was locked in its own close-fitting glass case, toothed with icicles. When the babies cried, she became like those trees, first rooted, then frozen. Their wails seemed as remote and unanswerable as the cries of birds circling their ice-filled nests. Addison had been on the Josephina when they were born. Annabelle had begun labor on September 4th, 3 weeks early, and the twins were finally expelled more than a day later
an eternity later, before dawn on the 6th, the first day of the Battle of the Marne. No names had occurred to her, and she had waved a hand in acquiescence when the midwife suggested Marion and the doctor offered James to be called Jamie. For Annabelle, the horror of the birth had merged with the horror of the war, now that she knew what it was to scream, to bleed. The birth had become the new trouble to which her mind returned when she let her guard down. The basin of red water reappeared, the doctor's knives and forceps and sewing needles. She saw again the purple infants smeared with blood and something like custard, as small as puppies, and she was revisited by her first horror at the sight of them, her fleeting, addled belief that the doctor was holding her organs in his hands, that she had been eviscerated. The midwife had told her the birth would be a trial, but afterward, joy would overwhelm her. Either the woman had been lying, or more likely, Annabelle was an unnatural mother. When the babies were 5 days old, Addison had returned. He had stood looking into their bassinet with a puzzled expression, and then at Annabelle, where she lay rank with sweat, her hair matted. She'd been refusing to bathe because the doctor said warm water would encourage milk production, and she was determined for hers to dry up. "Cool water, then," the day nurse said, "to soothe your parts." Annabelle had told her she would rather die than take a cold bath. "Your business is with the babies, not with me," she said. "Leave me be." She had matched Addison's silence. And the next day he left again. "Only a touch of the melancholies," the day nurse said. "I've seen it before. You'll be yourself again soon." Yourself. A memory from the murk of her first years. Moonlight bluing the nursery curtains. Her father beside her, holding her. No one ever held her. The warmth of another body was intoxicating. Instinctively, she had clutched the silk front of his robe and felt him trembling. There, the memory ended. Age 7, she was standing in the pantry in the house in Murray Hill with her dress lifted, while the cook's son, a boy of about 11, crouched in front of her. A jagged cry from the doorway and a great flapping rushing in. Bosomy, bustled, black-skirted nanny overfilled the small space like a crow jammed in a house for sparrows. The cook's boy yelped at being trampled. Nanny gave only that one cry. Then nothing but agitated nose-breathing as she dragged Annabelle upstairs and locked her in a closet. Dark in there, but with a keyhole view across the hallway to the nursery. Her yellow quilt on the bed, and a doll abandoned face down on the floor. "Was I bad?" she had asked Nanny through the door. "You know you were," Nanny said. "You are the worst kind of girl. You ought to be more than ashamed." What lay beyond shame? Annabelle wondered, crouching among dustpans and tins of furniture polish. If what she had done was so abominable, why was it permissible for her father, the god of the household, vastly more powerful than even her mother or nanny, to touch the part of her that the cook's son had offered her a piece of lemon candy only to look at, the part that nanny called her cabbage? "This is our secret," her father said about his visits. And mother must not know because she would be jealous of how much he loved Annabelle and how much Annabelle loved him and how they were warm together. The day she showed her cabbage to the cook's boy, her mother beat her on her bare legs and backside and called her wicked, wicked, wicked. The first doctor prescribed daily baths in cold water, a vegetarian diet. Nanny refused to answer any questions about the nature of wickedness. "That sort of talk will only encourage you." Although once, when Annabelle had asked if boys' cabbages were bad, too, Nanny had burst out with,
Stupid child, boys don't have cabbages. They have carrots.
Wickedness, it seemed, had to do with vegetables. Uneasily, guiltily, for reasons she could not have begun to explain, Annabelle began during unsupervised moments in the nursery or the bath to touch her cabbage. The sensation dulled her mind in a pleasant way, built to an absorbing comfort, even had the power to drive off unwelcome thoughts. The skinned lamb, for example, that she had seen in the kitchen with its tongue hanging out. Or her mother calling her wicked. It even muffled thoughts of her father. Her father said he was trying to do something nice, that his visits filled her with dread must mean there was something wrong with her. She would try to be better. Age 9, she woke to a gust of cold air, morning light, her yellow quilt being snatched away. Her mother stood over her, clutching the quilt like a matador's cape. Too late, Annabelle realized her hands had, in her sleep, migrated under her nightgown. "Wicked," said her mother, rearing over her like an axe about to drop. The next night, Nanny bound Annabelle's wrists, and she slept with her fingers interlaced as though in prayer. "Your mother is a good woman," her father told her, patting the cords on her wrists but not untying them. "But she doesn't understand how we want to be warm together."
"Am I wicked?" Annabelle asked.
"We're all a little wicked," said her father. The second doctor was old and houndish, with pouchy eyes and speckled skin and long earlobes. With tongs, he extracted a solitary leech from a glass jar. He nudged her legs apart. A ringing pressed in her ears. An obscuring white light swirled in like a snowstorm, was rent apart by a bright jolt of smelling salts. The doctor went out to speak to her mother, leaving the door open. "Overexcitement," he said. "Very serious. Not cause for despair yet." More cold baths and a borax solution to be applied weekly. She was to be kept away from spices, bright colors, quick-tempoed music, anything lively or stimulating. Before bed, she was to be given a spoonful of syrup from an amber bottle that sent her into a bottomless sleep. Some mornings, she thought she detected the faint smell of tobacco on her pillow. But she remembered nothing. The day she woke, 12 years old, terrified in bloody sheets, her mother told her that she would not die, but the blood would come every month as a reminder to be always on her guard against, yes, again, always, wickedness. Around then, two other events. First, she noticed she had not smelled tobacco on her pillow for some time. And second, she was sent away to school. The sunny chatter of the other girls, their books and bedtime prayers and homesickness and letters to their mothers, the cheerful dances they practiced with one another, their fussing over their hair and pinching of their cheeks for color, all of it made her feel like a small dark spider scuttling among their merry shoes. In a rush of fury, she understood she knew nothing of the world. She had been kept from it. How to remedy her appalling ignorance? Be attentive. Eavesdrop. Sift and strain for clues. Choose books at random from the library. Steal more books from other girls, especially the forbidden ones they have kept hidden. Read Wuthering Heights and Treasure Island and 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and The Moonstone. Read Dracula and have nightmares about the zoophagus madman in the asylum, Renfield, who feeds flies to spiders and spiders to birds and eats the birds and wishes to consume as many lives as possible. Steal The Awakening and dream about walking into the sea, though you have never been in any water but the bathtub. Even at school, her baths are cold. From these books, gradually pieced together jumbled theories about how other notions of shame and wickedness exist besides your mother's. Intuit that some women wish to be touched by men. The girls sighed over certain books, lying back on their pillows. "So romantic," they remarked, though not to Annabelle, whom they found strange. When she was sure everyone else was asleep, she returned to touching what she no longer thought of as her cabbage, but as her thing, not greenly inert, but alive and animal. The sensation became sharper, a piquant fishhook that snagged on her nerves as though on a net, pulling her along. She found a flickering and thrumming, a pulse and flash. Once a week, a young man came to the school to instruct the girls in piano. He leaned over Annabelle while she sat on the bench, and with his long fingers sounded low, tolling notes. He was almost as blonde as she, with arched, surprised eyebrows and comb marks in his hair. She took his hand one day and put it on her dress, over her thing. The terror in his face baffled her. In disgrace, she was sent to another, lesser school, but within a month, she was called home because her mother was dead. Her father treated her with distant, bewildered politeness, seemed not to remember that once he had wanted to be warm with her. Nanny was gone, and when she asked, her father said Annabelle was too big for a nanny, wasn't she? Annabelle took a bath so hot she emerged looking cooked. Only later, overhearing gossip at the funeral, did she learn her mother had drunk a whole bottle of sleeping draught. A third school, the one with the maple trees, the ice storm. Her history teacher was older than the piano tutor and not afraid of her. He found reasons to summon her to his office. "Like a fish to water," he said after he had relieved her of her virginity on a sagging sofa. "I could see it in you. I could see you would be this way." "What do you mean?" "It's in your gaze. Didn't you mean to seduce me?"
"I suppose so," she said, though she had not quite known what she meant to do.
She had simply returned his glances, allowed him to proceed, felt a dull, sawing pressure while both of them remained mostly clothed. Afterward, as she crossed the school green, the sadness that seemed to be the aftermath of any human contact settled on her. But the experience had not been unpleasant, and she returned to his office willingly when he next summoned her. He turned away and fumbled with himself beforehand, which he said had to do with avoiding a child. With practice, she could draw the flickering and thrumming from his ministrations, occasionally even the pulse and flash, though the sadness afterward remained.
"Let's run away together," he said,
and she had gazed at him from the sofa, confused he would think there was anywhere they could go. She was not expelled from that school, but graduated at 16 and returned to New York. As best she could, she adopted a life of outward respectability as spinster consort to her father, his companion to dinners and parties and on his travels. She tried to be good, to ward off her wicked need, but she could no sooner chase it away than she could chop off her own head and continue living. She found lovers. Their discretion varied.
"Maybe you should consider marrying," her father said.
They both knew no one in New York would dream of marrying her, despite his wealth. Lovemaking brought relief, yes, but also shame, rumors, scorn. She wished to be different, to be someone who did not go with men, who was not oppressed by blackness or possessed by wanting. But she failed. She failed in New York. She failed in London. Perhaps an English husband,
her father had said, in Copenhagen. Perhaps a Danish husband, and Paris, perhaps, and Rome. No talk of an Italian husband. She failed on the Josephina. She had not thought she could possibly have a child, had been certain her womb was rotten with wickedness. Addison Graves, she said to her father after she was certain of her pregnancy.
Who?
The captain, the ship captain. On the night she met Addison, her father had gone to the smoking room after dinner, entrusting Annabelle to the ladies' parlor, which was easily escaped. She had stood at the Josephina's stern, studying the black water, the silver clouds of bubbles welling up from the propellers. Fear had coursed through her, binding her hands to the railing. She imagined the rush of wind, the shock of the cold, the huge slicing blades, the retreating lights of the ship. Would she have time to watch the ship disappear over the horizon? Would she be left alone at the center of a starry black sphere, to have as her last sight infinite quiet points of light? Nothing could be lonelier. Or, she thought, more truthful. In her experience, proximity to other humans did not actually diminish solitude. She imagined herself drifting down, down, settling on the ocean floor, one final cold bath to extinguish what burned. The wind cut through her dress. She could never predict when her willpower would give way, but on that night, wickedness saved her, pulled her away from the ship's wake, and drew her to Addison's cabin instead. At dinner, he had seen her for what she was. She'd felt the force of his recognition like a slap. Perhaps, the day nurse suggested, if she held her babies, she would be reminded how beautiful they were. She was lucky to have two healthy children when some lost their babies at birth, poor souls. God made women to be mothers, the nurse said. If you have any sense, if you love your God, you will keep them away from me, Annabelle said, and the nurse, frightened, had taken the babies and gone, shutting the bedroom door behind her. Against her doctor's advice, she had placed ads for wet nurses in the newspapers before the twins were born, and hired the first two women who applied. They both claimed to be married. Neither offered an explanation of how her breasts had come to be full of expendable milk, and Annabelle did not ask. In my opinion, the practice is not far from prostitution, the doctor had said. Often they place their own babies under the most appalling conditions so they may sell their milk. They are not likely to be good women. But goodness did not interest Annabelle. When she had left Addison's cabin and returned to her own at dawn, her father had been sitting awake in his room beside an empty tumbler and full ashtray, still in his tie and tails, waiting, the communicating door left open.
Annabelle, he said.
He looked old and tired, resigned.
What should I have done differently for you?
You should have let me sleep, she said, and shut the door. New York City, October 1914, 1 month later. Lloyd Pfeiffer in mourning was outwardly no different from Lloyd Pfeiffer in the bloom of happiness. His coat and hat were impeccable. His collar was the ideal of whiteness and stiffness, his tie knot without flaw. He walked at a clip. But for a month, the Lloyd Pfeiffer enacting Lloyd Pfeiffer's life and habits had been no more than an animated carapace, a hollow effigy. Inside was a shadow, a twist of smoke, a dark spirit peering out as he perused manifests and negotiated coal prices and lunched on Crab Newberg and screwed his mistress. What was there before, the jovial but ruthless man, full of scornful intelligence and restless energy, seemed to have drifted away with his son Leander's last breath. Diphtheria, age 6. Matilda had still not emerged from her bedroom, separated from Lloyd's by their dressing rooms and a shared sitting room, and had eaten almost nothing. The surviving boys, Henry, Clifford, Robert, were kept out of the way by their nanny. And Lloyd didn't know if they spent their time in morose sniffling or if they hollered and brawled. He had never been interested in his children's daily affairs, and he would not have anticipated that, upon losing one, such pain would rise, black and primitive as oil, from his particular bedrock. Henry, who was 12, had come to him in his study one night and politely asked to be sent away to school. Lloyd had demurred, saying his mother needed him close. "But she doesn't even want to see me," Henry had said. "She never answers when I knock." "Women," Lloyd had said, "resort to theater when they wish to demonstrate the depth and superiority of their emotions. Indulgence will only prolong the spectacle. She'll emerge when she perceives no advantage to continuing." The boy had gone away, stung and downcast. In the small hours, tired of lying awake, Lloyd had thrown off his blankets and gone striding through the intervening rooms and into Matilda's bedroom, intending to scold her for her torpor, to command her to rouse herself. But Tildy, in her bed, had wordlessly lifted her arms before he could speak, and he had fallen into them and wept onto her chest. This was the first time he had cried for Leander, except for the day the boy died, when he had curled forward to submerge his face in his bath and wailed into the water. Nor had he embraced Tildy since he could not remember. She smoothed his hair while he cried, and he cried until he slept. In the morning, he left her room without a word. But the next night, he returned to her, and the warmth of her thawed him. The night after that, he had pushed up her nightgown and made love to her. Since then, a week had passed, the days and nights taking on an inverted quality. The dark spirit ruled in the day, and at night, his wife's body exorcised it. What Tildy thought about his visits, he didn't know. But on this morning, as he left the house, she had been sitting at the breakfast table with the boys, wan and silent, but upright, among the living. Lloyd's chauffeur drove him down almost to the end of Broadway, not far from where Manhattan dipped its toe into the sea. After the birth of Robert, their third son, Lloyd and Matilda had sold their Gramercy Park house and joined the northward migration of fashionable souls to a new house at 52nd Street, lengthening his commute. He'd thought about relocating Eleanor's offices at least a bit uptown. Some of their business was already being conducted at the Chelsea Piers. But the idea of separating himself from the entrenched and collusive downtown herd of shipping offices and ticketing halls made him uneasy. But then he worried he was becoming pig-headed like his father. Even as Ernst's wealth had begun to accumulate, he had refused to move the family from their cramped apartment on Pearl Street. Having endured the upheaval of one child, he refused to give his wife another. He yielded from sail to steam power too slowly, without imagination. He only ever spoke German at home, took only German language newspapers, seemed to have no interest in the country where he had settled beyond its capacity as an enormous machine that manufactured money. On the stroke of 8, the chauffeur stopped in front of a stately limestone building and Lloyd let himself out. He ignored the doorman's flourish of welcome, walked swiftly across the columned lobby to the elevators. The 9th floor was deserted at this early hour. On the walls hung immense maps, marked with routes and studded here and there with pushpins designating ships' locations, adjusted daily. What little space was left was occupied by framed paintings of the Eleno fleet, most prominently the Josefina Eterna and her newer sister ship, the Maria Fortuna, named upon her launch for an aging soprano Lloyd had been enamored with at the time. In Lloyd's office, the early editions had already been arrayed on his desk by his assistant, a marvelously unobtrusive young man. Ordinarily, Lloyd would call for a cup of tea and page efficiently through the newspapers. But on this day, he sat motionless, gazing at the war headlines. Germans marauding through Belgium. Trenches dug as graves for the living. The war sinking into the soil of the continent. A sudden red burst of rage, as though from poked at coals. He wished for Germany to lose the war, to be humiliated, for his father to return from the dead to see it happen. He wished for everyone to learn what it was to lose a son. He wished for a black slick of grief to spread across the planet. Thousands had left New York, eagerly returning to their birth countries to participate in the bloodshed, immigration in reverse. The wave of enthusiasm had passed, though, and Eleno's ships were running eastbound at less than half capacity. Lloyd wondered if Ernst would have gone back to Germany, taken up a rifle in his bony old hands. Perhaps. Or he might have found some covert way of aiding the fatherland. By spying, maybe, or by smuggling supplies and munitions. Or he might have been too stubborn, too slow to do anything, even to profit. He swiveled to look out the window. To the west, he had a slot view of the Hudson between the buildings. He hoped to glimpse the Josefina when she passed by later on her way to the Chelsea piers. He thought he would like to have a drink with Addison Graves. It was a bother, Lloyd's Germanness. His middle name, Wilhelm, now seemed incriminating, an act of corporate sabotage on the part of his father. But this war might offer new opportunities. There might be a role for him, a part to play. He was not his father. Here, the memory of Henry quietly closing the study door behind him intruded and was pushed away. "How is your wife?" Lloyd asked Addison. He couldn't bear to inquire about the new babies, who had arrived only a few weeks before Leander's death, an unjust windfall of life. Addison studied his whiskey. "Only God knows, to tell the truth. She seems to spend all her time in bed. The day nurse told me she takes no interest at all in the babies, doesn't wash or feed them. The nurse said sometimes new mothers have difficulties, but none have ever frightened her like Annabelle. She called it a terrible gloom. The gloom's in our house, too. They should mark the doors, like for the plague." "I'm sorry. Did you receive my condolences?" "Ah, probably. I don't know." Lloyd preferred gin to whiskey. He took a gulp. "None of that matters, I'm afraid. Condolences and so on, but thanks all the same. What has Annabelle got to be down about? Is something wrong with the twins?" "No, they're perfectly healthy." "Is she ill?" "She won't see a doctor. She hates doctors. But I don't think illness is the problem, at least not of the body. She seems to be almost mourning the birth, as though... Well, I don't understand it."
"Make her see a doctor."
"Yes, maybe I should."
"You've been at sea too much."
"On the ship, I know what to do." The bones in Addison's face seemed more pronounced than ever. The skin hanging hollow between his cheekbones and jaw. His brow shadowing his eyes. The dark spirit stirred in Lloyd, spiteful toward Annabelle, who lolled in bed, burdening her husband, neglecting her infants. Surely unable to imagine the suffering endured by himself and Matilda. He yearned suddenly to be home, to feel Matilda stroking his hair. He had never told Addison, but before they married, Lloyd had encountered Annabelle a few times at society dinners, had heard rumors about her so seamy as to seem implausible.
"You're too patient," he said to Addison. "Tell her to get up, make herself useful. Women like to be useful. Remind her how lucky she is. Give her a change of scene. Remind her she's alive."
He felt himself going red in the face. His voice grew harsh.
"Scrape her out of that bed with a shovel if you have to."
Addison looked up, something unreadable in his expression.